The Oracle Network. Well, hey there, friends, and welcome back, and happy February. We made it through the first month of 2021 practically unscathed, and we're all still pushing through, and I'm so happy to be with you here today. For today's episode, I'm going to cover Dean Corll and the Houston mass murders. And yes, I know, I hate him too. His name incites feelings of absolute disgust and pure rage for anyone who's familiar with this case, partly because of what he did to so many teenage boys, and partly because he recruited two other teenage boys, Elmer Wayne Henley and David Brooks, to help him lure these victims back to his home so that he could torture, rape, and murder them. There is some mystery around this case in terms of how Corll got away with this for as long as he did and what his true number of victims is. But what's no secret is how one of his recruiters, Elmer Wayne Henley, shot and killed Corll when Corll refused to stop heckling Elmer after not being able to rape a young girl that Elmer had brought back to the home. Even though the leader of this murderous trio was dead and couldn't be charged with the crimes, Elmer Wayne Henley and David Brooks were both convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison as a result. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Dean Corll was born into a tumultuous life in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on December 24, 1939. His parents fought constantly, and they divorced when Dean was six, only to get back together 5 years later after they all moved to Houston, Texas. They separated for the last time around the time Dean was 14 in 1953, and his mother soon began dating another man. During the first decade of his life, Dean was treated pretty horribly by his parents, according to sources that I found. They severely disciplined him for the slightest mistakes, and he was often in the care of a babysitter rather than his parents, which has obvious good and bad effects on a child. Good because he got a break from the supposed abuse, but bad because it only further reinforced in him that his parents wanted as little to do with him as possible. As a child, he, quote, suffered from rheumatic fever, which left him with a heart condition that meant he missed a lot of school, end quote. He was remembered as being a bit of a loner, but well-behaved, and he performed well enough in his classes that he wasn't under the teacher's microscope. He wasn't being looked at or thought of as a problem student or anything like that. In his teens, he went on dates with girls from school, but nothing that ever really amounted to a serious relationship. With little support at home, his mother was now remarried. Dean eventually graduated high school at 19 years old and began working for a few years in a candy shop that was owned by his mother and his stepfather. It had originally started as a small business run out of their garage, but Pecan Prince soon grew much bigger, and Dean and his younger brother Stanley would help run the machines that made the candy. From 1960 to 1962, Dean was sent to Indianapolis to take care of his grandmother, but when he came back to Houston, he had no real plans for his future except to continue working in his mother's candy business, which was now called the Corll Candy Company, and she actually appointed him the vice president of the company. On August 10, 1964, he was drafted into the Army and was stationed at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and then Fort Benning, Georgia, and then finally Fort Hood, Texas. But his time in uniform would be short-lived. However, during his brief stint in the military, Corll had an eye-opening realization. He was gay. Corll left the Army after serving barely 1 year on a hardship discharge, which is what happens when a soldier is released from their service obligation because they're returning to their family will, quote, materially affect the care or support of the family by alleviating undue and genuine hardship, end quote. What the hardship was, I don't know for certain, but one of my sources indicated that he was requested by his family to see if he could get out of the military because he was needed back home to help run the family business. Otherwise, his mother would have been unable to keep it up and the family would have suffered financially. So the hardship discharge request was granted and Coral received an honorable discharge on June 11th, 1965. Now that he was back home, he began working at the candy company again, but it was noticed how he would openly flirt and befriend many of the young boys who worked or hung out near the candy factory. He also became known around the neighborhood as the Candy Man because he would give out candy to local kids, and it wasn't like he was taking it off the shelves of the candy store and handing it out for free. It was usually pieces that were broken and couldn't be sold, and they were just going to get thrown out anyway, so he decided to give them to the local kids. But knowing what we know now, it probably wasn't because he was doing a nice thing. He was probably doing this to help groom a lot of the young boys that were around the company at the time. To most outsiders, this behavior wasn't really a concern. However, prior to his military service, one boy who worked for the Quarles had complained that Dean, quote, had made sexual advances towards him. His mother fired the boy, end quote. After Dean returned from the army, he allegedly had a pool table installed in the company's break room where he and a lot of the boys would meet and hang out. Now, clearly looking back, this is predatory grooming behavior. And one of those boys was 12-year-old David Brooks, who would go on to become one of Coral's accomplices just a few years later. In 1968, the candy company closed, and Coral got a job at the Houston Lighting and Power Company as an electrician. By now, it was 1970. Coral wasted no time in grooming Brooks directly. Brooks's parents were divorced, and only his father lived in Houston now, so whenever he'd visit his father, he'd also sneak away and see Dean. It seemed like a much better alternative than being constantly berated by his father, who looked at David as a disappointment. Soon, the so-called friendship between David Brooks and Dean Coral turned sexual, with Coral sexually abusing Brooks for the next 2 years, quote, bribing him with gifts or money for his silence, end quote. Brooks eventually dropped out of high school and considered Coral's apartment as a welcoming second home when he needed it, and there was no suspicion from Coral's family either. His mother and half-sister had actually relocated to Colorado after the candy company went under, and after that, they only ever talked to Dean on the phone. Just months into this arrangement, it's believed that Coral committed his first murder on September 25th, 1970. Jeffrey Conan was an 18-year-old freshman at the University of Texas who was out hitchhiking with a friend trying to get a ride to Houston, where his parents lived. When the person who picked him up dropped him off at the corner of Westheimer Road and South Boss Road, it would actually be the last time anyone ever saw him alive. For anyone unfortunate enough to cross paths with Dean Coral, he would initially come across as very kind, helpful, normal, and at this particular time, Coral lived in an apartment on Yorktown Street, which wasn't far from Westheimer Road, where Jeffrey Conan was dropped off. So, it's suspected that Coral saw Conan and offered to give him a lift to his parents' house, which Conan would have likely accepted. He was hitchhiking to his parents, so what would stop him from refusing another offer for a ride? 3 years later, after Coral was shot and killed, David Brooks, along with Henley, would lead police to where Jeffrey Conan's body had been buried on High Island Beach in 1970. Forensics testing done on the body revealed that Conan, quote, had died of asphyxiation caused by manual strangulation and a cloth gag which had been placed in his mouth. The body was found buried beneath a layer of lime, wrapped in plastic, naked, and bound hand and foot, suggesting he had also been violated, end quote. And because Coral had been able to get away with the murder of Jeffrey Conan, he decided to go one step further. He promised Brooks $200 per boy if Brooks would help lure young boys to his apartment. So this proposition was actually made in addition to a green Chevy Corvette that Coral bought Brooks in exchange for keeping his mouth shut after Brooks walked in on Coral torturing two teenage boys that he had strapped to a wooden board in his apartment, whom Coral later confessed to killing. At the time, Coral told Brooks that the, quote, two boys were part of a gay porno ring, end quote. So now with Brooks on board to help Coral recruit his victims, the number of teenage boys who disappeared without a trace skyrocketed, often being classified as runaways because at the time it wasn't illegal for a minor to leave home in Texas. On December 15, 1970, 14-year-olds James Glass and Danny Yates were at a religious rally near Coral's apartment in Houston Heights when they disappeared. Brooks and Glass were friends, and Glass had even been to Coral's apartment previously. So when Brooks convinced Glass and Yates to come with him to Coral's apartment, they didn't hesitate. They didn't see anything wrong with it. But as soon as they were inside the apartment, both boys were tied up and strapped to the wooden torture board before Coral raped and strangled both of them. Both James Glass and Danny Yates were buried in a boat shed that Coral had rented a month prior. Beginning in 1971, Coral, with the help of David Brooks, began preying on teenage boys that Brooks knew, and therefore, by seeing their friend David Brooks in the company of Dean Coral, they wouldn't be as threatened. They would feel safe around Coral. They would feel like he was trustworthy because their friend David was with him and didn't seem concerned or threatened. On January 30th, brothers Donald and Jerry Waldrop disappeared while heading to a bowling alley. Both boys were strangled and buried in the boat shed. What's heartbreaking is that the boys' father was, quote, working on the apartment next to Coral's at the time that Donald and his brother were murdered, end quote. So their father was within feet, probably 10, 20 feet of the apartment that killed his sons. A month and a half later, on March 9th, Coral assaulted, shot, and killed 15-year-old Randall Harvey, who was last seen heading home from his job at a gas station. On May 29th, 13-year-old David Hilligeist and his 16-year-old friend Gregory Malley Winkle were last seen climbing into a van. Winkle had actually worked at the Coral Candy Company and was dating the sister of Coral's previous victim, Randall Harvey. David Hilligeist would actually end up being one of Elmer Wayne Henley's childhood friends. Now, this was before Henley joined Coral and Brooks as an accomplice, but the connections there are kind of mind-blowing. On August 17, 1971, 17-year-old Reuben Watson was heading home after seeing a movie at a local movie theater, and he ran into David Brooks. Brooks had met Reuben before, so he urged Reuben to come to a party with him at Coral's apartment, and Reuben agreed, only to enter the apartment and find himself trapped, to be raped, strangled, and then buried in the boat shed. After this murder, Coral asked David Brooks if he knew of another boy who would be a good fit, and this is when Brooks introduced Coral to Elmer Wayne Henley. But it's suspected initially that Henley was taken to Coral's apartment to be killed, not to be recruited, as Coral had already killed Henley's friend Hilligeist. Upon meeting Henley, Coral knew right away that he would be perfect to help Brooks kidnap young teenage boys, so he offered Henley the same deal that Brooks took, $200 per boy, for a supposed, quote, sexual slavery ring operating from Dallas, end quote. Now with two accomplices helping him, Coral would become unstoppable. Initially, Brooks and Henley would only bring victims to him, but eventually, all three of them started to participate in the torture and murders. As time passed, Brooks and Henley found that they were more successful in convincing these boys to come to Coral's apartment if they offered them the chance to smoke marijuana and drink alcohol as well. Throughout 1972, at least nine teenage boys were murdered, including suspected victim 17-year-old Willard Branch, 18-year-old Frank Anthony Aguirre, 17-year-old Mark Scott, who was actually a friend of Henley's, 17-year-old Billy Balch, 16-year-old Johnny DeLone, 17-year-old Stephen Sickman, 19-year-old Richard Kepner, 14-year-old Wally J. Simoneau, and 13-year-old Richard Hembry. At one point, 19-year-old Billy Ridinger had been taken to Coral's apartment and tortured, but Brooks somehow convinced Coral to release him. So Ridinger actually escaped, but was probably far too terrified to report what happened to him to police. So Coral continued to skate just below police's radar. Some of these boys were actually convinced to lock themselves in handcuffs by either David Brooks or Elmer Wayne Henley, who would then leave them alone with Coral, who would then attack them. Additionally, during 1972, Coral was somehow able to keep his activity quiet despite relocating to at least one other apartment. And furthermore, the fact that Brooks and Henley assisted Coral didn't keep them safe from attacks either. One time, Brooks was knocked unconscious upon walking into Coral's apartment by Henley, and when Brooks woke up, he found himself tied to Coral's bed and then was raped repeatedly by Coral. Even with this treatment, Brooks couldn't find it in his heart to leave Coral. Perhaps he was too afraid of what would happen to him if he did try. I mean, he was probably pretty near to 100% sure that he would be the next murder victim if he tried, because he knew the intimate details of Coral's crimes. He himself was guilty by assisting him, and if he was allowed to live, he would easily be able to inform police. Over the course of 1972, both Brooks and Henley also became more brazen about their participation in the attacks. According to a statement by Brooks after his arrest, Henley, quote, was especially sadistic in his participation, end quote. Brooks recalled how Henley would sometimes be the one to actually kill the boys, either by strangling them with his hands or shooting them in the head. And what blows my mind is how these two boys would bring their friends to Coral, knowing what would happen to them. Like with Mark Scott, he was brought to Coral's apartment, and as soon as Coral tried to grab him, Scott began fighting back as hard as he could, quote, even attempting to stab his attackers. However, Scott saw Henley pointing a gun towards him, and according to Brooks, Mark just gave up, end quote. And Mark Scott would end up meeting the same fate as all the other boys, and yet Henley and Brooks didn't seem to even feel the slightest bit of guilt in helping to kill these boys that they knew, and some that they even considered friends. All right, friends, I'm going to take a short break, so hang tight. I'll be right back. And welcome back. Now, despite how horrific 1972 was, the next year would prove to be just as deadly. In January, Coral relocated to a new apartment, but only lived there for almost 2 months before he moved again to Pasadena, Texas. During this time, he claimed one victim, 17-year-old Joseph Lyles, who was kidnapped on Wirt Road on February 1st and beaten, raped, and buried in early February. However, it's noted that, quote, no known victims were killed from February to June 3rd of 1973, although Coral is known to have suffered from a hydrocele in early 1973, which may account for this sudden lull in killings, end quote. And a hydrocele is essentially swelling in the scrotum and is caused when the scrotum has become inflamed or injured. So it's likely that given how ruthless and brutal Coral was to his victims, that he might have injured himself during the assault of Joseph Lyles and therefore was physically unable to commit any sexual assaults on any other victims during this time, so that's why there was a break in attacks. However, once Coral was recovered, his bloodlust was out of control, and the next 2 months would result in the murders of 8 teenagers. According to Henley, Coral would turn to him and Brooks and say he, quote-unquote, needed to do a new boy. And with that, the boys knew that this was their cue to head out in search for a new victim. Four boys, 17-year-old John Sellers, 15-year-old Billy Ray Lawrence, 20-year-old Ray Blackburn, and 15-year-old Homer Garcia, would be raped, strangled, and buried between June 4th and July 12th. Three were buried at Lake Sam Rayburn, while Sellers was buried at High Island Beach, and when his body was recovered, he actually had the distinction of being the only victim buried wearing his clothes. In July 1973, David Brooks stepped back from his duties when he decided to get married to his pregnant girlfriend. And with this, Elmer Wayne Henley became the one responsible for all of Coral's recruits. In the span of 1 week in mid-July, Henley assisted in the kidnapping, torture, and murders of three teenage boys. 15-year-old Michael Balch, who sometimes went by Tony, and was actually the younger brother of Coral's previous victim, Billy Balch. There was also 18-year-old Marty Jones and 15-year-old Charles Cobble. Coral later buried Cobble and Jones in the boat shed, while Balch was buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. On August 3, 1973, Coral would claim his last victim, James Dremala. He was a 13-year-old boy who was last seen out riding his bike near Coral's apartment. He was allegedly pulled into Coral's van by David Brooks, who had decided to come back after his wedding break, and they took him to get pizza before Brooks drove him to Coral's home. And they did this and convinced James to come along by telling him that he could collect empty soda bottles to resell and get the deposit for them. But once inside the apartment, Coral forced James to call his parents, quote, to tell them he was at a party across town, end quote. Coral then strapped him to the torture board and raped and strangled him using a cord before taking his body to be buried in the boat shed. Thankfully, the nightmare that is Dean Coral would come to an abrupt end in the early hours of August 8, 1973. The night before, Henley had invited 19-year-old Timothy Cordell Curley to Coral's house for a party, like he had done with just about every other victim. Curley was meant to be a victim, but as the two boys drank and sniffed paint, passing the hours with their debauchery, they decided to go out for sandwiches. When they were on their way back, Curley and Henley stopped by Henley's home, where he saw his 15-year-old neighbor, Rhonda Williams, who was outside and in the process of leaving her home after suffering a brutal beating from her drunken father. In a moment of compassion, Henley offered to let her come back with him and Curley to Coral's apartment and just hang out until her father sobered up. So the three got into Curley's car and headed back to Coral's apartment. Around 3 a.m. on August 8th, Henley, Curley, and Rhonda walked into the apartment and were met by a furious Dean Coral. Knowing that Rhonda was there ruined any chance of following through with the attack on Curley, but after Henley explained why she was there, Coral seemed to regain his composure, at least outwardly. And believing that Coral was okay with the situation, the three teens began drinking and smoking marijuana until they passed out a couple hours later, with Coral standing off to the side nursing a beer as he watched them. Henley was awakened suddenly when he felt the cool metal of Coral's handcuffs clamp shut around his wrists. He glanced down and saw that his ankles were tied and that both Rhonda and Curley were bound and gagged on the floor next to him. Curley had been stripped naked. Coral growled at Henley that he never should have brought Rhonda to the house, and now he had to kill all of them after he tortured Curley. Henley watched as Coral kicked Rhonda repeatedly in the chest as she screamed through the tape covering her mouth before she eventually passed out. Coral then walked over to Henley and dragged him into the kitchen, all the while screaming at him for ruining everything before pointing a loaded .22 pistol at his stomach, telling him that he was going to shoot him. Henley was able to talk Coral down and convince him not to kill him by telling him that he would help him murder both Rhonda and Curley and that no one would ever have to know. This, thankfully, was enough to satisfy Coral, who then released Henley as Coral went to bring both Curley and Rhonda to his bedroom. Once Curly and Rhonda were tied to the torture board, Coral ordered Henley to cut off Rhonda's clothes with a knife and rape her as he turned his focus on Curly and began to sexually assault and beat him. As Henley tried to rape Rhonda, she regained consciousness and screamed at him, asking him, "Is this real?" To which he replied, "Yes," and attempted to continue on with the assault. Rhonda, not knowing what was going on and finding it really hard to believe that this was happening, looked at Henley again as he stopped and asked him again, saying, "Are you going to do anything about it?" With this, it was like a light bulb turned on over Coral's head, and he turned to Coral and asked if he could take Rhonda to a different room, but Coral ignored him. So then Henley grabbed the .22 pistol, pointed it at Coral, and shouted, quote, "You've gone far enough, Dean. I can't go on any longer. I can't have you kill all my friends," end quote. And Coral was furious at this point. He began walking towards Henley, daring him to shoot him, telling him that there's no way he'd do it and that he was weak. But just as Henley took another step back, he braced himself, raised the gun, and fired. The shot hit Coral in the forehead, but it wasn't enough to stop him, and Coral continued to advance on Henley, who fired two more shots, hitting Coral in the left shoulder. Realizing that Henley really meant to kill him, Coral turned to run out of the room as Henley fired again and again and again, hitting Coral in the lower back and shoulder as he slid down the wall, dying shortly after. Once Henley was sure that Coral was dead, he untied Curly and Rhonda, and as they put their clothes back on, Henley asked them what they thought they should do. Henley wanted to leave. He wanted to get out of the house and go as far away as he could, but Curly told him they should call the police, so that's exactly what Henley agreed to do, as he went and got the phone book and looked up the number for the Pasadena Police Department. As Henley dialed the number to the police department, his heart thudded in his chest, and at 8:24 a.m. on August 8, 1973, operator Velma Lines picked up the call. Before she could barely get a sentence out, the voice on the other end of the line shouted, quote, "Y'all better come here right now. I just killed a man," end quote. And after she was able to get the address from the caller, Velma dispatched officers to 2020 Lamar Drive, Pasadena, Texas. After Henley hung up the phone, he, Rhonda, and Curly all sat on the front porch, waiting for the police to arrive. After a few moments of silence, Henley confessed that he'd done that before, and Curly looked at him puzzled. Quote, "I've done that 4 or 5 times, end quote, Henley said, meaning that he had killed someone by shooting them before. As the police arrived, Henley got up and walked over, telling them that he was the one who had called as they walked up towards them. After retrieving the .22 pistol and putting all three teenagers in the police car, police went inside and found 33-year-old Dean Coral dead from multiple gunshot wounds, just like Henley had reported. Henley was read his Miranda rights and began walking police through the last 3 years. 3 years of luring teenage boys to Coral's home where he would rape and murder them. He told police about Coral offering to pay them $200 per boy, and when Curly was being questioned, he told detectives that before police arrived, Henley had told him that he could have gotten $200 for him. Henley confessed that he, along with David Brooks, helped Coral murder some of the boys and dispose of their bodies, but hearing all of this made police pause for just a second. It seemed too horrific to be true, and Henley was still under the influence of drugs from the night prior, but he insisted that he was telling the truth, that this wasn't a drug deal gone wrong, that there were actually bodies buried in a boat shed in Houston. He told the police some of the victims' names, which they recognized because some of them were recently reported missing, so a search was initiated of Coral's home. There, police found the torture board made of plywood, handcuffs, several large knives, petroleum jelly, tape, rolls of clear plastic. The floor in the bedroom where the torture board was located had actually also been covered in that plastic. They found sex toys, rope, glass tubes. They also searched Coral's van, a large Ford Econoline that had its windows blacked out. Inside the van, there was more rope, a dirty chunk of carpet, and a large wooden crate that had holes on all sides, as well as what appeared to be human hair inside the crate. There was a board attached to the walls of the van that had hooks and rings on them, and it was clear that what Henley had been telling them was the truth. Dean Coral had tortured and killed these boys in his van and in his home. Henley also offered to escort police to the boat shed as well as Lake Sam Rayburn and High Island Beach to recover the bodies. Upon entering the boat shed, which was actually boat shed number 11, there wasn't a whole lot to look at. They, quote, found a half-stripped car, which turned out to have been stolen from a used car lot in March, a child's bike, empty bags of lime, and a box full of teenage boys' clothing, end quote. But despite there being no bodies and nothing to indicate visually that there was anything except some old junk there, the smell was overpowering, and Henley persisted. He told them that they needed to dig. So police brought in a team to begin digging up the dirt in the shed, and soon enough, they had to excavate the entire ground of the shed. They found multiple victims wrapped in plastic, covered in lime, and at various stages of decay. And they also noted that not all of them had been killed the same way. Some were strangled, others had been shot, but all of them had been sexually assaulted and tortured. Coral had even castrated some of his victims while they were alive and kept their genitals in plastic bags. By the end of the day, on August 8th, police had uncovered 8 bodies. Later that evening, David Brooks walked into the Houston Police Department, escorted by his father, and he confessed. He told police that he denied, quote, any participation in the murders, but admitted to having known that Coral had raped and killed 2 youths in 1970, end quote. But eventually, the stress of keeping Coral's crimes a secret any longer was too much to bear, and Brooks broke. He told police that he was helping Coral long before Henley was. He told them about the Corvette that Coral had bought him, as long as he agreed to keep his mouth shut, that he didn't tell anyone what Coral was up to. He explained that Coral had offered him $200 for each boy that he brought to the home. And as days passed, Henley brought police to Lake Sam Rayburn, and both Henley and Brooks accompanied officers to High Island Beach. By August 13th, 1973, a total of 27 bodies had been recovered from the 3 burial sites, although Henley insisted that there were as many as 4 others still out there. And this number ended up passing Juan Corona as the deadliest murder spree in U.S. history and became known in the news as the Houston Mass Murders. Despite the stomach-churning confessions of Henley and Brooks being nearly unbelievable, autopsy reports for each of the bodies proved that they were telling the truth. There was evidence of strangulation, mutilation, sexual assault, and abuse found on each one. And when the news first broke, Henley and Brooks were actually heralded as heroes for stopping a vicious predator like Coral. But soon the public opinion of both boys changed. They were not heroes, and they had actually helped Coral kidnap, assault, and murder these boys in exchange for money. In April 1983, another body was recovered from the Jefferson County beach and was identified on November 11th, 2009, as 17-year-old Joseph Lyles. As of 2018, one of the victims has yet to be identified, but there is speculation that it could be a boy named Bobby French, although that is not confirmed. Dr. Sharon Derrick, who works as a forensic anthropologist, is hoping that she can identify him sooner rather than later. She said, quote, "I just want people not to forget about this," end quote. Additionally, the body of Mark Scott was never recovered, and initially a body found in the boat shed was misidentified as his and then was later determined to be that of Stephen Sickman. Based on Brooks's and Henley's confessions, it's now believed that Mark Scott was buried on High Island Beach. Unfortunately, when Hurricane Ike came through Texas in 2008, it flooded the beach area, so there's no guarantee that Scott's body is still there or will ever be recovered. After the search and recovery efforts stopped in 1973, both Henley and Brooks were officially charged for their roles in the murders. Elmer Wayne Henley was convicted of 6 counts of murder for Charles Cobble, Marty Jones, Frank Aguirre, Johnny DeLone, Billy Lawrence, and Homer Garcia, and received 6 life sentences on July 6, 1974, while in 1975, David Brooks was convicted of 1 count of murder for Billy Lawrence and received 1 life sentence. On May 28, 2020, David Brooks died in a prison hospital in Galveston from COVID-19 at the age of 65. Elmer Wayne Henley, now 64, is still in prison serving his time and thankfully has been repeatedly rejected for parole. He became eligible in 1983 and will meet his next parole board in October 2025, but hopefully the trend will continue and he will remain behind bars for the rest of his life. Dean Corll, with the assistance of David Brooks and Elmer Wayne Henley, is considered an organized lust killer. Each of his victims were, quote, typically lured into his van with an offer of a party or a lift and driven to his house. There, they were either plied with alcohol or drugs until they passed out, tricked into putting on handcuffs, or simply grabbed by force. They then were stripped naked and tied to either Corll's bed or, usually, a plywood torture board, where they were sexually assaulted, tortured, and sometimes after several days, killed by strangulation or shooting with a .22-caliber pistol. Their bodies were then tied in plastic sheeting and buried in any one of 4 places, a rented boat shed, a beach on the Bolivar Peninsula, a woodland near Lake Sam Rayburn, where his family owned a lakeside log cabin, and a beach in Jefferson County, end quote. He had a plan for each attack, a way to kill each boy, dispose of their body, and never come under any real suspicion. The way he killed each of his victims was meant to induce as much pleasure, both through his sexual release, but also to inflict as much pain and suffering on each boy as possible, further heightening his arousal. Dean Corll is one of the most disgusting, treacherous human beings to ever walk the face of the earth. And while Brooks and Henley can also be looked at as victims who were preyed on by a sadistic rapist, they are also guilty for their participation, paid or not, because they chose to help in the torture and murder of innocent teenage boys. It is a relief that Henley killed Corll when he did, or else his number of victims would be exponentially higher than the 28 victims that we know of. Okay, my friends, that was the Candyman, Dean Corll. Thank you so much for sticking that one out with me. I know it was rough. As always, if you have a particular case you're interested in, I'm still taking suggestions for the next few months to fill in my schedule. I have cases pretty much picked out through April, but beyond that, I'm open, so if you have ideas, let me know. You can reach out to Mask of Sanity on any of the social medias, or you can email me at maskofsanitythepodcast@gmail.com. And I would love for all of you to stick around after the show for the promo trailer for the Pineapple Pizza Podcast. This is a joint collaboration from a few different podcasters. It includes Emily from Drink Drunk Dead, Ashley from Studying Scarlet, and Lindsay from Ye Olde Crime. And in this show, they talk about anything and everything mythological, cryptozoological, and urban legend related. And it's funny, guys. Seriously, this show is such a joy to listen to. So if you need something that is a palate cleanser or a break from true crime, I totally get it. This one is definitely one you need to check out. They're one of my go-to lighter shows when I need a bit of a pick-me-up. So go subscribe on whatever platform you listen, and if possible, make sure to leave them a 5-star rating and review. Thank you all so much for listening and for your support. And please join me next week when I release one of my previously recorded Patreon episodes covering the case of Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Welcome to Pineapple Pizza Podcast,
where we serve up delicious slices of mythology,
cryptozoology,
and urban legends.
I'm Ashley.
To anyone who doesn't know me that well, the fact that I'm laughing right now probably horrifies you.
I'm Emily.
What are the chances?
I don't know.
Like bum bum bum.
50-50? Oh.
And I'm Lindsay.
I banished you to the shadow of death. I corrupt you to the netherworld from which no one has come.
Pineapple Pizza Podcast. Stop on by for a slice, a story, and a laugh. Coming January 2021.